Welcome inside 254. Let's close the office door and start the conversation.
Today's Talk Around the Table is about Nikki Haley, who is the U.S. Ambassador at the United Nations. And the first thing I want to talk about is what exactly that job is, because I hadn't really ever thought about it. I always know who that person is, but I didn't know exactly what their role was. The United States has its own representative with the title of ambassador, and this is all thanks to ABC News. They really articulate this for us. An ambassador is a diplomatic official accredited to a foreign country or government, or in the case of the United Nations, an international organization, to serve as the official representative of their own country. So Nikki Haley is the person at the table who represents the United States. So that has some power, but really it's a more of a like a liaison position. The permanent representative, as she is called, represents the United States interests. And the number one duty is to keep the U.S. State Department informed of events at the United Nations. The ambassador then makes recommendations to the State Department and the president as to what course of action the United States should pursue. Every ambassador finds their own niche. Some are really loud and boisterous and try to have a lot of power. Some more act as a liaison and just report back. If you remember, like, James Bolton. Is that his name? James Bolton?
John Bolton.
John Bolton. So if you remember him, he was a flashpoint figure. Like, everybody had something to say about him. So a U.S. ambassador to the United Nations is approved by the Senate after being nominated for the president. By the president. And Nikki Haley was voted in 96-4. So she, if you think about the Betsy DeVos debacle and how she was a flashpoint for all these debates, like, Nikki Haley, everybody kind of agreed on her, that she wasn't the one that people decided to have the fight over. We'll talk about how she's doing, but she's early on in her process. And what brought her to our attention was that comment that Donald Trump made about her at the table that we'll get to in a second. The Senate confirmed her handily, and she has been there, and she's been in the news a few times. What we're going to do is try to help us all understand what her role is and really think about what she's going to do. What will be her issues? Because she hasn't really said yet. So we're going to watch and see, but Amanda has given her a grade. Are you going to talk about that crazy comment?
I wasn't going to. Trump... I was not. Do you want to start with that? Let's talk about the crazy comment, because I do. I give her a C, a 74% okay. Specifically. And yes, I actually graded her the way you would a student. But well, so I have actual individual grades for subject categories. I know the comment you're talking about.
Yeah, what got her back on my radar was in April. April was a very strange month. When Donald Trump was sitting at a table of assembled ambassadors, Nikki Haley was sitting by his side, and Donald Trump said to all these ambassadors, "Does everybody like Nikki? Otherwise, she can be easily replaced."
Yeah.
And how there was a lot of news about, well, what, you know, my argument was like, well, what was she supposed to do? Like, get up and storm away? But this kind of flippant idea that she's easily replaceable, that women in their workplaces, mm-hmm. you know, here's everybody getting a good laugh at her expense mm-hmm. when she really hasn't even had much time to do her job. So let's remember that, you know, the context in which she is working, I think, is really challenging. I think a C grade is pretty fair. I mean, that's a medium grade.
Yeah, I actually started off at a B-, and then I went through the individual segments, right. Actually, it's more like 74%. So I'm going to start with what she's done well.
Okay. That's always good. Good teacher. Pedagogy.
Right? Start with the positive.
Yeah, good pedagogy.
Okay. So I give her a 90% on climate change. Here's why.
Wow.
I know she's looking at me in disbelief. Hang on.
Let's hear it.
Here's why. And it's kind of generic, but it's the same benefit of the doubt that I would extend to any student who started dealing with something that maybe they weren't completely sure about. She told CNN's Jake Tapper, quote, "President Trump believes the climate is changing and he believes pollutants are part of the equation."
What?
So she also said, despite leaving the Paris Agreement, that Trump is still committed to a clean environment.
Here's the thing, right?
So she has now essentially publicly nailed down Trump's stand on climate change. And it is that an acknowledgement that yes, it is changing, and yes, people and their pollutants are part of it. So I give her a 90 on that because that is not consistent across Trump and his administration. So
wait,
I figure,
I was just going to say, that's not what he said.
And here's the thing. If this is, she's presenting the perspective, or is she maybe pushing back a little? So I'm looking at it like, well, I'm going to give her, again, the benefit of the doubt. I'm not going to hold her feet to the fire the way I will hold Trump's, because maybe she's saying, nope, yep, this is where we're going. So I give her a 90.
Okay.
I also give her a 90 on talking tough on Syria, Russia, and Iran in ways that, I mean, Trump just hasn't gone there yet. So according to a Yahoo News story, quote, during testimony before the House panel on foreign operations, Nikki Haley also called Assad barbaric. So this is something Trump has come out against Assad, right? But she takes it.
Language,
she goes where he won't go. So she said she can't envision a healthy Syria if he remains in power. She said, quote, the goal is at this point not just to send Assad a message, but to send Russia and Iran a message. That if this happens again, this chemical attack on their own people, if this happens again, we are putting you on notice. My hope is that the president's warning will certainly get Iran and Russia to take a second look. In other words, she's taking it to a next level with Russia and Iran, where Trump isn't going, because Trump won't say anything bad about Russia. He won't criticize Russia. He's not, he's...
But this to me feels
so. I'm giving her a benefit of the doubt.
An easier promise, because all that she can play, in my mind, she can play fast and loose with that, because the only thing the UN can do is send in peacekeeping forces.
True.
So
she did tweet, though, since now we're in an era of everybody just
tweets or policy.
Everything tweets or policy. She warned in a tweet.
What did she warn?
That Russia and Iran, which are Assad's key backers, would also be blamed for any further attacks done to the people of Syria. So that's much stronger language than we've seen coming out of the White House. So I
blamed
have to
by
give
who
her,
though? The United Nations or by the U.S.?
She's our U.S. ambassador to the U.N.
So
she represents
is that
us.
U.S. policy?
She's I All take right. it as she's representing the U.S.
Okay.
So again, we're not seeing that direct connection language coming out of the White House, but we're seeing it out. So I have to give her a 90. Again, I'm like extending her the benefit of the doubt. Okay. So those are the good things.
Okay.
Here's what she's done questionably.
Okay.
And this is the 75% grade. She criticized the UN's Human Rights Council in June. She made a statement in Geneva criticizing the council's five, what she called, biased resolutions against Israel. She said she planned to propose ideas that will make, quote, the Human Rights Council more effective, more accountable, and more responsive. And then she suggested that Venezuela maybe consider stepping down from the council, quote, until it can get its own house in order. No country who is a human rights violator should be allowed a seat at the table. So that I'm kind of, see, this is what I'm sort of torn on. I'm thinking, okay, yes, that's true. If your nation is a human rights violator, being on the Human Rights Council might not be a good fit. And yet, it also sounds to me like she's shilling for the administration. Like, isn't that just a talking point? Is that really true? So
Donald Trump literally has praised people who are committing such terrifying human rights violations in the Philippines that the person who cataloged it won a Pulitzer.
Mm-hmm. So there's a contradiction there that I'm a little confused by this. So that's why I give her a C, because I don't think that was the right approach, or what she did was
a strange unilateral move. And that's always been the U.S. It depends on who it is, the U.S.'s role, because basically this position is the second most important position in the UN, other than the Assembly General, the person who's in charge of all the UN that we were hoping was going to be a woman this time and wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
But then her role is basically the second most important position.
Right.
So,
which is why I say this is questionable to me. It's confusing to me. So I don't want to fail her on this, but I'm thinking, yeah.
Again, it's early.
It's early, so we'll see what she does. I mean, maybe this is like what you said. Is this one of the areas she's going to carve out for herself? Is this an area?
As soon as you were talking about that, that's what I was thinking. I was like, so is this going to be her? And
I don't know. Maybe it is. But here's what she's done badly. And that shows
she's
her to
be... She's had time to do bad stuff?
Yeah, okay. And I think this shows her to truly be a shill of this administration. And I'm hoping that that's not the trajectory. But there are three things on this list where there are only two and one on the other two areas. I give her a 65%. She criticized the Obama administration for the Iran nuclear agreement. She said, quote, "They're going to continue their nuclear capabilities, and we just gave them a lot of money to do it with. And my concern is they're associating with all the groups we're trying to defeat. So not only did we give that capability to Iran, we're now giving it to those terrorist organizations we're trying to defeat." So I give her a D on that. That I don't think that's what happened with that agreement. I mean, I admit I'm not an expert in that agreement, but the things that I've read, I don't think that's what's happening. So I think this sounds like a talking point.
To hear John Kerry talk about that, who brokered that deal, he talks about that as like the pinnacle of his time as Secretary of State.
Right. So
here he is thinking like this is a great thing. Mm-hmm. And here she is saying on behalf of the administration that it's a terrible thing that puts us in danger. Right. So that really is going to be a partisan issue.
It just sounds to me like a talking point. The other thing is she has been accused of violating a law that limits government employees' political activity by tweeting her support for a congressional candidate in South Carolina who did eventually win his special election.
Okay.
So she tweeted support for this guy.
Yeah.
And now she's being called to account for that because government employees are not supposed to do things like that. Show support for one candidate
over
another.
So she was like politicking she was a diplomat.
She was a politicking and in the role as a government employee, as a representative of the United States.
That's definitely something that lots of people have been doing.
I almost gave her an F.
Forget.
I almost gave her an F on that, but I thought, I'm going to give her a 65. Maybe she didn't really know.
Right.
I'm going to give her that, but she's still, that's a D.
Okay.
And finally, she bragged on Twitter.
Ugh,
about,
this one makes me crazy.
About cutting the UN peacekeeping budget. This is her tweet. "Just 5 months into our time here, we've cut over $500 million from the UN peacekeeping budget, and we're only getting started." I don't think cutting the UN peacekeeping budget is something to brag about. That's tragic. So I gave her a D. Again, I could have given her an F, but
that I would give her a zero for.
Right. That's why I'm saying, like, just to, because she's new, because it's only a few months in, it's early. I'm thinking, all right, I'm just going to give her a 65 and we'll go from there. And when I average it all out, comes to a 74%. She's got a solid C right now.
Okay.
We'll see where she goes from here.
And listen, it's a hard job.
Yeah.
And we want her to do well. Yeah. I think that that's maybe something people could forget is that we have a vested interest in these people doing well. So that's why we have conversations about them. That's why we're trying to hold them accountable, because we want these people to do right, what we consider right.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you were very fair in your assessment of that.
I'm trying to be, but I'm holding my breath just like everybody else, trying to see, like you said, where is she going to carve out her niche?
Yeah.
What categories of that, where is she going to really run with this? What is she going to really focus on? And how is it going to impact us at home? And also, I'm curious if she's going to have any influence or ability to sway Trump and his administration.
Well, she will not. Based on that, like, weird, flippant, she can be replaced. I mean, that was a direct threat in front of everybody.
That's how I read it.
Oh, me too.
Threat. Yeah.
You can be replaced.
Yeah.
If my boss were sitting next to me and said, "You can easily be replaced," I would not feel comfortable in my position or feel comfortable in my ability to say, you know, I think maybe this is not the right path. And you've asked me to be the expert in this situation. So I'm going to tell you, as the expert in this situation, it's not going to go well. I don't really feel like you can say that if you have been told you're going to lose your job.
Unless she is going to carve out her space and say, look, I'm going to represent the U.S., not just Trump, right? And that's where the point about climate change, the point about bringing Russia and Iran into the Syria discussion, I'm hoping that's her way of drawing a little bit of a harder line on something that could have been a very soft point, you know, from Trump's position. She didn't have to
she's
bring
not
in
dummy.
Russia.
She's a politician. No, she knows how to do this.
And she's got bipartisan support, which
right.
means she's good at being a politician and walking the line. We're going to have to look and see how much she pushes back. And if she does end up pushing back in a bigger way than this, will she still have the job?
Well, I'm going to follow her on Twitter now.
I already do.
Yeah, she's one I don't. So I appreciate you letting us know that she's so active on Twitter. I will be following her as well just to see what she has to say.
Yeah. So let's keep an eye on Nikki Haley.
Let's see if she can get her grade up.
Yeah, we'll see.
There's no extra credit.
There's no extra credit. Just improve.
Yeah.
All right. Until next time.
Thanks for grading her.
Mm-hmm. Time for... Trumpster fire. Colleen.
Amanda.
We need to talk about the fact that the world now hates us.
Do they really hate
us? They do. Reuters, there was a Reuters headline just from a few days ago. Trump is tanking the world's opinion of America. And that's Reuters. So according to a Pew survey that was just done, basically other countries hate Trump even more than we do. A median of 22% of people across 37 nations have confidence in Trump's foreign policy. So only 22% of people. 55% in this survey in Europe do see Trump as a strong leader, but larger majorities surveyed see him much worse. 75% think he's arrogant, 65% think he's intolerant, and 62% think he's dangerous. Comparatively, the median on the world stage who had confidence in Obama's global leadership was 64%. So Trump is at 22%. Obama was at 64%. The only positive here is that the people who, the respondents in the survey, seem to be able to, at least at the moment, make the distinction between Trump and his administration and sort of the governing structure and the American people. The survey did show that 58% of respondents had a positive view of Americans in general. And in many regions of the world, a majority or a plurality of respondents said they expected the relations with the United States to stay roughly the same despite Trump. So if there's any positive, but I just don't like the fact that we've tanked so precipitously with Trump at the helm.
But I am heartened at the ability to see the line between American policy and Americans. That has not always been the case. As somebody who traveled a lot during the Bush administration, I would have to explain policy a lot. Whereas traveling during the Trump administration, people's response is usually just like, what the fuck? So I haven't been in that position as much. And I think it would be really hard worldwide to not see that a lot of Americans are unhappy with Trump being president. So I think that that kind of resistance, if you're feeling like it's not working, I think in this place it is. It really is working to show the rest of the world that we, a lot of us, do not think that this is an okay way to lead. So that's good. That's heartening, that ability to distinguish between American policy and Americans. Like when I was traveling in Sri Lanka last year, I'm in Anuradhapura, which I love that word because it's onomatopoeia, but Anuradhapura, and I love that's saying great. which delighted me. And I'm like under a piece of the Bodhi tree that somebody had brought from Buddha, from India. And this guy who's loaning me socks out of a shack so I can walk because you're barefoot, but it was so freaking hot at that point. And he's like, where are you from? And I'm like, I'm American. He's like, what is up with Donald Trump? Now, I don't even know if Sri Lanka has a president. And I've been there. And that story just reminded me how everyone else in the world knows what is going on in the United States. And it is easy to forget that what happens here is a clarion call to the rest of the world. Everyone else is paying attention because they know they need to, because whoever is leading the United States is going to direct policy that directly impacts geopolitics. So here's this guy talking to me in the middle of Sri Lanka about Donald Trump. And we have to remember that we are exporting him, and we are exporting whatever he says and whatever he does and however he acts. And so none of these numbers that you just read to me are surprising. Fareed Zakaria, who is totally my academic crush. So Fareed, if you're listening, I love you and I've always read you in Newsweek. But you wrote in the Washington Post in May that, quote, Trump is turning other countries against the United States. But far more damaging in the long run might be what some have termed the, quote, Trump effect. His impact on the domestic politics of other countries. Now, we did see, I want to step out of this quote for a second. We did see that Marie Le Pen did not win in France. So there was a reason everybody was kind of watching that bellwether to see if the Trump effect was kind of going to export. Was Brexit going to, you know, Brexit bumped over to the United States, and then was that going to bump over to France? And it didn't. So Farid might be happy about that. And the effect appears to be powerful, negative, and enduring, and it could undermine decades of U.S. foreign policy successes. And I know people that are really nationalistic, don't really care about U.S. foreign policy, or thinks that we have too much U.S. foreign policy. I get that, but I also think that's a short-sighted vision of our role in the world, because we participate in the world.
We do.
We don't get to act unilaterally. And we don't get to just shut ourselves off from the world. And I think Obama did a really good job of being that kind of shining star of giving speeches and talking and visiting the world and sitting down with people.
And listening.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not seeing that at all. Yep. I'm not rooting against Donald Trump. If he started doing that, I would be thrilled. But it just doesn't seem like it's in his character or his personality. And in fact, I think he thinks that's a strong point of him. But this is why other people are saying he's arrogant. Mm-hmm. But that is an interesting number, the overlap. Like, it seems like some people think arrogance makes you a good leader in the overlap of those numbers.
Right, because so within that intolerant, arrogant, right, you also have 55% of those people who are saying those things think he's a strong leader.
See that as strength.
Yeah.
And I don't.
No, I don't either.
I know why people do see that as strength, but I would like us all to rethink that.
let's rethink that. A definition of leadership.
Yeah.
Let's rethink the definition of leadership.
Yeah. Let's have conversations about that for the next 4 years. Like what you're hearing? Hey, Podbean listeners, see that green Become a Patron button at the top right of your screen? You can click on that, donate $1 a month, and get a cool sticker, a Facebook shout-out, and our undying gratitude. iTunes listeners, we didn't forget about you. If you go to our Facebook page, you'll see a blue Shop Now button. Click that button, and it'll get you to that same site. Thanks for keeping us sustainable.
Let's take a time out for a media minute.
While the real world rages about healthcare, our ruined U.S. reputation, and the cruelty of the heartless GOP, sometimes I need an escape. Of course, my fictional escapes often mirror and parallel reality too closely for comfort. Nonetheless, today I present my favorite women characters on Game of Thrones. Season 7 just started on July 16th and is as good or better than the previous six. Some critics dislike this show because of its abuse of women, especially early on. And when I sat down to watch the first season, I did so under duress, and I found myself yelling at the TV more than once for gratuitous rape, unnecessary boob shots, and torture porn. This show definitely requires trigger warnings. However, I stuck with it and soon found myself rewarded with women characters who started developing into fully formed human beings, with agency, power, and fearlessness. In fact, Bustle wrote an article about the series in 2016 titled, How Game of Thrones Became One of the Most Feminist Shows on TV. Vanity Fair published an article around the same time called Game of Thrones, How Women Went from Victims to Conquerors. I was hooked by season 2 and found the payoff in season 6 and now again in season 7. If you watch the show, you might expect me to talk about Cersei Lannister, the focused, immoral, and fierce mother queen regent who flexes her power unapologetically and without mercy. And you'd be right. She is a force to be reckoned with and was easy to despise early on, but has developed into a complex woman character who is quite simply an admirable warrior moving through a world of men who are determined to destroy her. My other two favorites are Brienne of Tarth and Yara Greyjoy. Brienne started off as a warrior and a fighter with a strong moral compass and a sense of loyalty and duty, but her compassion and commitment to do the right thing complicates her character. And I love that she takes up space. Physically, she takes up a lot of space as a very tall, broad, strong woman. She is visible and present when on screen. You cannot help but see her. And that is a pleasant divergence from the way women are usually expected to either be sexualized or just disappear on screen as pretty window dressing. Brienne is the window, the structure, the immovable object. I love seeing her in scenes. Yara Greyjoy is another strong woman warrior who is complicated by her loyalty to her family and how she responds when that loyalty is violated. She is tough, wise, and flexible as a leader. She makes mistakes and she owns them. In fact, all three of these women characters are flawed in ways that sometimes make them hard to love. And that's what makes them so compelling and honest. If you haven't watched this series yet, I recommend doing so. But you'll have to get through some pretty rough stuff in the first two seasons to get to where we are now. But it's worth it to see women characters to come into their own in a male-dominated world, even a fantasy one.
Let's end today's podcast with some activist actions.
A few episodes ago, we talked about our concerns with Nikki Haley and the global gag rule being re-implemented. And as we know, the global gag rule was re-implemented, but actually in a harsher state, something that we talked about in a different episode. So my activist action this episode is to really educate yourself about what the global gag rule is. Cecile Richards does a short video that is on the Planned Parenthood website that you can watch and learn exactly what the global gag rule is and why it matters. And Planned Parenthood is doing work to try to make sure that it is not continuously reinstated. So my activist action for this week is to continue to pay attention to the global gag rule or the Mexico City policy. You might hear it called that. Because this is the number one, in my opinion, the number one thing that impacts women around the world. When people said to me there was no difference between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, the first thing I would bring up was that Hillary Clinton would not have the global gag rule and Donald Trump does. So if you think this global gag rule doesn't matter, you need to educate yourself. And Planned Parenthood is a really great video that will help you understand so you can talk intelligently to other people about this issue as we approach the midterm elections. Thanks for spending time with us inside 254. You can find us a lot of places online. You can follow us on Facebook at Inside 254 Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Inside 254 Pod. Instagram, we're at Inside 254. And we're online where we put links and more information from each episode at Inside 254 site, S-I-T-E, .wordpress.com. You can follow us on Podbean and please rate us on iTunes. Thanks for spending time with us this episode of Inside 254.